Hi, welcome everybody to the first of a series of five dialogues. I'm Nick Benadel, the founding director of GIBS, the Gordon Institute of Business Science. I'm facilitating these discussions with former President Chelimo Atlante and Rolf Meyer, who's a director in the In Transformation Initiative, and they will be our hosts. These discussions are hosted in collaboration with the Chelimo Atlante Foundation, the In Transformation Initiative, the Hans Seidel Foundation, Democracy Works Foundation, and the Gordon Institute of Business Science. The idea of these dialogue discussions came about to address the various societal and other issues that South Africa has been facing. During this tumultuous time of COVID-19, where normal seems like an unusual word to describe our daily lives, COVID-19 has brought with it numerous obstacles, and it further has amplified the deep structural problems South Africa already faces. So we felt there was a need for people to come together and share ideas on how to adapt and overcome these many daunting obstacles. The first dialogue discussion held on the 26th of June focused largely on the impact of COVID has had, broadly speaking, on South Africa and to some extent the world. How has it impacted our daily lives and how will it change our future? The rationale behind this dialogue was to try and understand what has fundamentally changed over the past few months, what will need to be addressed, and what opportunities exist to rebuild our political, economic, and social structures. Our first panelists were the former governor of the South African Reserve Bank, Jill Marcus, and the vice-chancellor of the University of Witwatersrand, Adam Habib. Their introductory remarks, contained in this podcast, explored the ways that society has fundamentally changed due to this pandemic, whether good or bad, as well as giving their thoughts on what South Africans must do to overcome some of these issues. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Colleagues, thank you for being here. It's a lovely initiative to be part of. I have been part of other conversations we've had. Former President Chelimo Atlante, it's lovely to be part of the conversation with you as well. Colleagues, I want to highlight what I think are the three big issues that are going to live with us as a result of the pandemic. And I think that it's worth starting by quoting Milton Friedman. I don't normally quote Milton Friedman, but what Milton Friedman once said is that humanity's greatest technological, scientific, and economic leaps occur from moments of crisis. It is the crisis that often focuses the mind. It forces diverse actors to come together and to think through the huge challenges and ultimately the trade-offs that are required to enable those advances. And it seems to me that COVID-19 is a moment of huge challenge, but it could become a moment of huge opportunity if we grasp the opportunity. And if we're going to grasp the opportunity, we need two things. We need leadership, and it seems to me that we need political courage and political will. And I want to say, I assume that will come to the fore, and if that were to come to the fore, there are three ideas that I would like to put onto the table. The first is what the pandemic has done is it's forced us to fundamentally change our operations. And the most dramatic example of this is in the university system for me. If you went back to early March, about 10% of our educational programs were online. If you went back 5 years ago, about 1% of our educational programs were online. But we've been experimenting for 4 or 5 years. And we've had some significant opposition to it. But what was striking is in the space of 3 or 4 weeks, we shifted our entire operations online. And we've been 8 weeks in that process. We're now entering our exams. And it is really incredible how a difficult moment enabled innovation and an opportunity and allowed us to shift all of our programs online. And that opens up a series of opportunities as we proceed post the pandemic. What I'm sure of is that some form of online learning is here to stay. I wouldn't think it's going to replace the university. I think there's too many people who are calling an end to the university. Remember, learning in a university happens as much outside the classroom as it does within. If you come to a place like WITS or UCT or Stellenbosch or UP or Forte, you learn as much from your peers outside the classroom as you do in the classroom. And so face-to-face interactions and networking and the ability to learn those soft skills to navigate a cosmopolitan community are still going to be important. But what it does suggest is that a kind of blended learning is going to be here with us for a long period of time. And that can address a whole series of challenges. Why, for instance, should we have classes of 1,000 or 700 people? Why not shift those lectures online and shift the face-to-face interaction to smaller tutorials and group work that deals with applied learning? So I think that what you're going to see is a fundamental shift in teaching and learning in business operations and from working online. And I think we haven't sufficiently used those opportunities. And that's going to fundamentally impact on all of our institutions. Universities, it's going to impact on how do we deal with, what is our infrastructure? What kind of learning happens? What kind of pedagogy plays out? But in businesses, I would imagine how big offices should be. How do we create a new learning and operational and business environment? How do we reimburse and remunerate people, et cetera? So I think that's the first thing that I wanted to highlight. The second is the issue of global partnerships and the importance of networks of institutions that are emerging globally. It's worth saying what this pandemic has brought to the fore in quite a dramatic way that we've been speaking about for some time is that all of our challenges are transnational in character. Whether you're looking at climate change, whether you're thinking about inequality, whether you're thinking about social and political polarization, renewable energy, and frankly, public health and global pandemics. All of these are effectively transnational challenges. And if you're going to address transnational challenges, you need great science, you need world-class technology, but you need local understanding. How you apply science and technology in local context matters. So if you understand the issue of effectively the pandemic that emerged in West Africa in 2015 and 2016, one of the most important things was not the kinds of vaccines and therapy that was required, but was trying to understand the social practices that lived on in West Africa. And you had to transform those to ensure that those drug therapies and treatment patterns work. So local understanding is absolutely crucial. Now, why is that important? Well, because our global partnerships until now has been the following. We identify talented people in the developing world. We take them to London and New York and now Beijing. We train them, and effectively many of them never come back. That's because life happens. In a sense, you enable the brain drain that creates a crisis. What it seems to me is if we continue to do this, we will never have the human resource capacities and the institutional settings that allow us to be part of the global knowledge infrastructure that would allow us to address the challenges of our time. And so long as we don't address those challenges, we will live with the consequences. So if you don't address Ebola in the middle of Burundi, it matters to people in London or New York, because all you need is somebody on a plane that lands at Heathrow or JFK, and suddenly the people in New York and London are as impacted as the people in Burundi. And so what we need is a new mode of learning. We need a partnership that is grounded in institutions rather than individuals. We need to build research institutions in the South as much as we do in the North. We need good public hospitals in the South and in the North. We need good research laboratories. And the only way you're going to do that is by creating networks of institutions. And what that requires is split-side scholarships, joint training. Don't imagine that Harvard and Oxford and Cambridge are going to train the leaders of the world. Those leaders have to be trained throughout the world in partnership with institutions so that we can bring global and local together. And so that's the second thing I wanted to highlight. And that requires a complete reimagination. And I think that's going to be on the cards after this pandemic. And then finally, economic policy. And I'm not going to say much more because I think Jill will touch on this. But I do want to say that this COVID-19 has brought to the fore, in the most acute sense, the level of inequality. It is the people we required most in this moment, the doctors, the cleaners, all the people who keep our streets clean, the people who will look after our institutions. It is those people that have to go to work in the midst of the pandemic. But yet our remuneration mechanisms, our remuneration structures do not look after these people appropriately. And what this brought to the fore is the deep, deep inequalities. And you see Black Lives Matter protests, in part, that has got to do with the deep racial inequalities across all of our institutions, across all of our society. And it seems to me that COVID-19 is going to have an impact on all of our economies in quite dramatic ways. There are some things that have reopened up. So debt to GDP ratios are fundamentally different post the pandemic than they've ever been before. The idea that you're going to have 3% debt to GDP or 6% debt to GDP ratios is out of the window. We've got the United States above 100%, Japan above 240%. Of course, that means that what is important in that context is growth. What is important in that is how you spend the money, how you invest in productive economic cycles, etc. But what we're going to have to do is reimagine our economies. And when we reimagine our economies, what I'm saying is you're going to have to reimagine at its heart the principle of inclusion. We are going to have to do effectively what was done in the world economy in the late 1940s, the reimagination of the world economy to rebuild social democracy, or what Milton Friedman and them tried to do in the late 70s by reimagining it, except that we're going to try and reimagine it away from how they built it, in very much along the lines of how it was reimagined, I suspect, in the 1940s, but in a manner that is more in tune with the 21st century, a globalized economy, an economy that is far more grounded in technological innovation, and where the world has been brought and made a village at the dawn of the 21st century. So three fundamental things. The nature of work is going to change with technology and online education and online work. Global partnerships have to be reimagined, and economic policy has to be rethought with inclusion at the very core.
Thanks. Morning, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. I'm taking what Adam has said as something that I would agree with in large part, but approach it from a different angle so that there's a wider perspective. And I'm looking at this as implications that really needs to move away from wishful thinking, what we would like, you know, in a sense of what we can do, what we should do, and what is not possible to do. We don't have capacity. And I wanted to start with the question of leadership. And as we know from leadership, the focus is always on what is good leadership. I think the reality of what we have at the moment is a range of examples across the world that reflect in essence bad leadership, shocking leadership, the inability to think beyond their own realities and to give guidance in that is both rational and thoughtful. And the rational question does come back into the way we see things, because rationality has been overtaken in many ways by dogma, by wishful thinking, by big man syndrome, if you like, And I think it is leading us into a very disastrous world. And there are real choices to be made. There's no question about that. So I want to cover, first of all, the human aspect. I think that the question of COVID is doing a number of things. First of all, mental health will be a very big issue. If you take older people who are primarily, although it is showing to change in terms of age group, but older people being affected particularly, in essence, older people actually feel thrown to the wolves and discarded. And therefore, I think, and the diseases that are the comorbidities are diseases of aging. And one of the things that I think will arise out of this, driven by people, because aging is a natural process, is you're going to have a much greater focus on aging and what causes aging rather than the diseases of aging. So there's going to be another whole body of work expanded around what does that actually mean, and longevity and health in your longevity is going to be a big focus. The second question around mental health is not just for older people, but for young people. If you take COVID and the ability to interact or to have a total distrust of your friends because you don't know whether they can infect you or not infect you, the social requirements of not interacting at a physical normal behavior and doing everything online for a considerable period of time is going to also affect young people who see themselves as, and young being very young as well, not just, you know, sort of teenagers and above, seeing themselves as threatened and vulnerable. And I think that there's going to be a really great need to look at the mental health consequences. The third element around mental health and human essence is the ability to manipulate through the current technology, to create parameters through the use of technology that creates straw men. It creates all kinds of attitudes. It creates all kinds of thinking for you without you even realizing it. And that is going to also impact. The more people use the technology, the easier it is to find ways to, if you like, channel and direct. And the fourth element around that in the human is the ability to organize through technology, which is both good and bad. As we've seen from Black Lives Matter and for elsewhere, you're able to mobilize, but it's also able to manipulate. So I think the human element is going to be extremely important, that sense of well-being and purpose and inclusion. And that comes back a little bit to what, Adam, you said about online. You cannot have online without increasing disparities in the current state of South Africa because you do not have blanket internet. So if you look at schooling, those schools that are endowed have the ability, and their kids have been, the kids at those schools, some government, but mainly private, have the ability to have not had, missed a beat. They're doing everything online and it's working extremely well. In the schools, for instance, that I'm dealing with, you haven't even got access to data, you haven't got access to internet, you have no online learning. So the kids are actually bereft. And the more you have online requirements, there is a real need to ensure that it is accessible, affordable, and consistent. And that is not possible in today's world, in the rural communities and in smaller communities, unless you get blanket internet. And that should be a top priority. So the human element for me is actually really important because that shapes the way we see, where the way we think of opportunities, and the way we're able to turn things that are really impacting negatively to create the new world and the new advantages. And you have to have motivation to be able to do that. The second question that I would relate to the technology side has become, because everybody is, and COVID is a superb example of that, because everybody has access to, or a significant number of people have access to the internet and everything, you've almost got a death of expertise. I've read a blog or I've read a piece of information and I equate that to 40 years of experience and knowledge and in-depth understanding of problems and issues. And therefore, opinion is as valid as I want it to be, and I can check on Google or wherever to see what it is that I know, don't know, or who is saying what, and it is equated. So it's not only about health issues, it's across the board, where you have a disregard for knowledge and expertise because everybody has access and knowledge and thinks that they know because they've read something. And then the third element that relates to that for me is that in actual fact, we have as a country focused on certification as our measure of education and not knowledge. And what we need to find a way to is to ensure that we have people with knowledge, people who know the basics. You can read and you can write and you can understand and you understand comprehension in any language. And it is a thirst for knowledge that we require, not simply a certification, as important as that may be. We can have the certification, but without the knowledge, and it doesn't mean very much. In terms of the economics, what I would focus on here is increased disparities. I think that you will have fewer, you do already have fewer and fewer people who control the superhighway of today. That is allowing or enabling countries to exist. They are larger than many of the countries in the world. And it is about a control in the same way as you had the railways and roads and motor vehicles and everything else and flights open up new opportunities. Your superhighways today are the internet and the ways in which that enables or controls. And I think that's going to be very critical because what we're seeing is more and more people becoming the unengaged, the them, with fewer and fewer people being the us, with greater and greater wealth and power. And therefore the increased disparities are enormously important in the reimagining of the economy and the inclusion. And that requires a whole range of things, because what is underestimated in all the things that I've seen happening at the moment is the interconnectivity of things. We do not look at cause and effect and interconnectivity adequately. And therefore, we make assumptions of outcomes that are not possible because we're missing some of the connections and patterns. And then I want to really just conclude with two things. I think that one of the challenges for reimagining is the extent to which lies are the norm. The lies have, we can say what we like, do what we like. It is, if I say it often enough and loud enough, it is the truth. And that is reinforced through the technology access. It is reinforced through the media abilities to actually have that kind of view. And in essence, what you've seen is that in this period, it has been in the outcome has been that, in fact, truth is a fugitive. Truth is something that we don't stand for, a value system that we don't stand for. And the pushback that you're seeing is an enormous civil society role that is required to push back against this question that lies prevail and truth is simply what I say it is. And that is huge in any reimagination, because if we do not understand the extent to which people have very firm views of what is real and what is not, when there is such a concerted, combined effort around manipulation of information and truth and lies, it is very difficult to overcome. So the question of lies is extremely important. And that relates to a second element of that, and that is rational thinking. We think if we simply sit down with somebody and explain it and we discuss it properly, people will understand it. And there is an absence of rational thinking. In fact, rational thinking is part of the fugitive of truth, because it is about persuasion and manipulation that is dominating. And there is that battle to actually get rational thought, logic, and discussion, the ability to discuss, because part of the current communication is that even the we're in essence coddling people's fragility and analysis, rational thought, ability to robustly engage on ideas has become unacceptable. It's being pushed back hugely, so that the ability for robust discussion and analysis and the ability to connect the dots between things is something that is now seen as threatening. And therefore you have this contestation around what is reality and what is possible. And then finally, I think that we need to look at what we have as who has voice in this debate. Who, where is the voice? How is that voice heard? And what we're seeing is that there is fewer and fewer voices heard in relation to, unless there's a real outburst like you have in Black Lives Matter. which has been a culmination over decades, but it's come to the fore at this point in time. And critical will be what happens to that. Because if it simply peters out, it becomes harder and harder to have anything that has strength and ability to effect change. And then the question for me would be, if you take South Africa, and I think, no, just let me, I didn't deal with the economic issues, so let me deal with that very quickly. You're seeing very rapid move to home manufacturing, the shortening of the supply chain to manufacture as locally as possible. You've seen in the circumstance that already 90 governments have blocked out exports of medical goods to preserve domestic supply, looking at bringing domestic production home from wherever it was, irrespective that it will cost more for their consumers at this point in time. That may well change. If you looked at US-Mexico dispute around automotive manufacturing, if you looked at the question of Wuhan being the center of automotive manufacturing parts and the consequences of that. So if you looked at the relocation of manufacturing, it's got a very serious implication for emerging markets. If you looked at the amount of funds that have flown out of emerging markets over this period, it is absolutely phenomenal. And therefore, that country, a country like ours that is dependent on foreign flows because we do not have enough savings, is going to have a real difficulty on sourcing funding. And then, of course, we have the levels of unemployment. And the ability, if you looked at the opportunities that will arise out of this, it is a more knowledgeable employment. It is a more educated. It is likely to be, unless there's concerted efforts made, it's likely to be something that's here to stay much longer than we anticipate. And therefore you have an army of the unemployed. And history should teach us that around the world, when you have an army of unemployed, there's usually one solution, and that tends to have been war. And if we looked at the provocations that are taking place at the moment, it can come from any angle, anywhere in the world. But I personally think that there is a virtual march to the inevitable. And if and when it happens, the atmosphere has been created that you will get narrow nationalism surfacing very, very quickly. Thank you.